hope burns eternal. You know, it's hope and the belief in tomorrow that has sustained us as a people in this province through all of the dark history that we've just described to you. It's always been about hope, hope for the future, hope for the children. You know, in our community, I know growing up, my parents and grandparents always urged, always said, you must get an education. You must get an education was a very valued tool, thing to have, because they seen that as a way out of our situation. And hope for tomorrow, that hope comes out of our churches. You know, wanted to talk about the African United Baptist Association, and our institution in our community was the church. That was the center of our community, that was the organizing place of our community, and that was the place that you went to get hope. In your darkest of days, when you didn't have a bite to eat on your table, you could go to your church and have your spirit maintained and uplifted and given new hope. And for our community, hope was a week at a time or 3 days at a time. And we built upon that hope. The hope today that we can see is that we understand that, well, for instance, Africville, you know, we've made a settlement with the HRM in terms of the past injustices. We are making strides forward that we recognize that those dark stories and our history is connected to a much larger base of people, because the black refugees, of course, of 1812 to 1815 came out of the Chesapeake Bay area in North Carolina and in Virginia. And I've been down to Virginia and reminding our cousins down there that we are all connected. So when I talk about economic development, you know, if you're economically independent, racism does not play a part in your life. It's only when you are dependent upon that person sitting across the table for your livelihood that racism matters to you. But if you're economically independent and that person who has no influence in terms of you or your children or your family, really, if they're racist, well, that's their problem. It doesn't become an issue with you until they are in positions of power and can influence your life. So economic independence is critical. We in Africville have hoped that the destruction of our community was as a community. And we look to the future that what we're building and what we're doing is for the whole community, because this is where my brother Eddie and I differ in terms of the question on Africville, and John can allude to what Eddie's position is. But our position, the Genealogy Society, and this is something that we got direction from our elders, who are all gone now. They're all gone. There's one, two, three, four, five landowners from Africville that are still alive. All the rest are gone. So it was their loss. And when we talked to them about, before they passed, about, well, what is the hope for the future, it was always about, you know, if there's anything that we want, it's an apology. We want them to say what they did to us was wrong. And whatever you do, do it for the children. So it's always about the children. It has always been about the children. And to let our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren know who we were as a people. Do not lose our history, because our community is. So that's been our mission, that's been our focus. And along with that, of course, you look at it and you say, well, you know, cultural tourism is the fastest growing industry around. We have a history to tell. And that bleak history can be told in such a way that we can attract people to come to our site so that we can become self-sustaining, that economic independence can be ours. Because the last thing we want to be is hat in hand every year looking for grants, looking for money. We don't want, that does not help us. We have to be economically independent so that we can grow the way that we feel we need to grow without having the constraints of the money person telling you, do this and do that, and here are your signposts, and don't go outside them. So that's the hope for the future, that we can build something so that our children, first of all, will never lose their history, and secondly, can see an achievement on the part of their people to inspire them to even greater things. That's our hope for the future.
And yeah, for this one, when I was thinking about this one, I wanted to focus my answer mostly around Eddie Carver. And I don't know how many of you know him, but his, you know, as I say, he was born in Africville, and as a child grew up watching the school come down, the dump come in, watching this, the slaughterhouses, the train tracks, this sort of continual encroachment and destruction and devaluation until finally in the 1960s it was just removed altogether. And you know, I mean, as somebody else had told me at a public event, it was probably post-traumatic stress disorder, that sort of total violence of having something completely taken away from you. You know, the psychological damage that that does to somebody is profound and you know, I imagine often undiagnosed. Mm-hmm. And the way it manifested itself in Eddie, and I, you know, these are stories he's told me to share with other people and that are all in the book, was just like a total, literally having the earth stolen out from under your feet and then trying to stand up again on nothing. And for him, that led to a spiral of drug abuse, of alcohol, of violence. And in a way, he sort of recreated Africville in himself, you know, being born a little boy with sort of the innocence of a child and hopes and dreams and plans. But then, you know, instead of a toxic dump that we put in Africville, he takes the drugs into himself and he pollutes himself. And instead of the violence of the community being destroyed, it's the violence of him into the people around him and into his life. But the hope side of it, I mean, Eddie has been to darker places than, you know, hopefully any of us have ever been to. And, you know, I hope that, you know, it's just dark places of you know, the dark night of the soul. But out of that, he kept going back to Africville and kept going back to what was for decades just a field. And then it was a $1 million award-winning dog park. And now it is Africville again. And for Eddie and for everyone, it's always been Africville. And he's always gone back out there, you know, when he got out of prison, when he was, whatever sort of trauma was happening in his life, that was the sacred ground he could go and sort of tap into the roots and to his ancestors and start to rebuild. And I wanted to read a passage, I'll just close the book, that I think kind of encapsulates this. This was a, you know, as I say, it was a great privilege for me to be able to interview Eddie. And in this particular section, we were sitting in his camper trailer, this one, the one next to this one here, this one is burnt out. And it was in the winter, it was freezing cold outside in Seaview Park. It's freezing cold outside, it's freezing cold inside a little summer trailer camp. And we had the gas heater on, and the windows were all closed and taped up, so it was dark. And it was just the two of us sitting there in near total darkness. But when Eddie starts to speak, when he starts to preach, it's like there's a multitude. There are millions of people, and it was just me, but it was, you know, it's an amazing experience. So this was a day like this. He started talking about this and how he found hope. I can see them fixing Africville, and I can see them fixing the rest of the problems, because it's not our problem to inherit. Somebody did something wrong, and they messed up our system. They gave us the face of a racist, and we don't deserve it because we're Canadians and we're all colors. The European forefathers who brought racism to Canada were wrong, he said. You're on the wrong horse. You're in the wrong country. What you did was wrong. You brought those people here in slavery. What they did in servitude, they dug out them streets. They hold a position in this country we call Canada. These people should have a role of prominence. We should pay homage and say, wow, what a fascinating country we've got. These people gave it to us. They carved out the roads. Let's make this a beautiful history. We can get everybody in this boat. We're the boat. We're the Canadians. And then he's talking about his own discovery of black history and of Africville's long culture. This gives you a pride that you feel deep down in your soul, and it makes you feel like you're going to last forever because you've got a worth, you've got a value. That's what the protest has done for me. I was broke in this city. I was a broken man. I came to Africville. I prayed so hard. I was so completely broke, I asked God to pick me up. I didn't want to be the liar that I was when I walked out of the city. I was everything to everybody, but to myself, my own worst enemy. I was creating no solutions, just problems. I took a look at myself and put a worth on myself, and I didn't feel very good about it. I felt like I was the worst human being in the world, and I deserved all these bad things that were happening to me. But when I started fighting for Africville, it changed me. I stopped being the center of attraction for me. I learned to put me far from Eddie. I distanced myself from him, because this me I knew was selfish. He was addicted. I couldn't trust him. He was broke. I started getting well through fasting, through abstinence. I'm guilty of sin about everything. I'm not the best guy in the world for this job. The Lord could have picked somebody else, a little more respectable, with a good reputation. But I'm the guy that was broke. I'm the guy that went down that road. I'm the guy that Jesus said hey to. He did that with Paul, too. Since I've been out here, I learned what discipline is, because you have to be very disciplined to be here. I've learned what it is to be patient. I realized how long a winter's night is and the extent of the rain. Stuff that I never thought about, I've had time to think about. Eddie fell silent. He watched the golden sunlight fade in the darkening basin as the earth turned from its star, facing the endless shadows of space. And so when you're in the presence of Eddie, when he's in that sort of almost an ecstatic preacher space, and I mean, I'm an atheist, so it doesn't, I don't really understand where he's coming from or where he's going, but I can feel the passion and that hope that goes right down to the core. And I think if you ever download the Africville Suite from Joe Seeley and listen to Deep Down Inside, you get some of that transformative power. And somebody had mentioned earlier that to move forward, you know, racism affects us all and it holds us all back. And you think if we can tap into this energy, this exuberant celebration collectively, then there's a huge, powerful way to move forward. And just one last point, you'd mentioned cultural tourism. I read a book last year called In the Province of History by Ian McKay, and he talks about the development of the tourism industry in Nova Scotia, and a big part of that was the Acadians. And when in 1750, when there was the expulsion, pretty much everybody left in Nova Scotia agreed that it was a good thing. Maybe it was a little botched in the handling, they were a little rougher than they should be, but basically it was a good thing that they had to leave. And that kind of just sat there for 100 years, and it wasn't until cultural tourism started to develop, and Americans, particularly through Evangeline, started to hear about Acadia, this land, and they wanted to come here. And so Nova Scotia sort of realized that there was money to be made, created this culture of Acadia, created the Grand Prairie site, created these things, and in doing so, somehow the Acadians went from being these sub-Nova Scotians, these not really full, they weren't, you know, they're Southern Europeans, they weren't seen as full Nova Scotians, but somehow that's changed, and now white people in Nova Scotia think of Acadians as part of who we are. And I think we're at a place similar with Africville where we generally don't think of Africville as part of our story, but it feels like we're on the precipice of turning that over. And so that maybe in 100 years' time, people will see Africville as just part of the broader Nova Scotian story, as part of our story, not as part of an us-them thing. And I think the, you know, the church.
Appreciate what both of you have said around hope. And in the racism, violence, and health study, at points, the research team and I, at times, you know, we were actually experiencing some vicarious trauma. When you hear all of the stories, when you read the transcripts, you hear about, you know, story after story about racism and the everydayness of it and the multitude of it. It was at times almost overwhelming. But there were also times when you just had this amazing sense of hope when you see how what people were surviving and the ways they were surviving. There's a whole chapter in here on coping. Then we end the book with this. Here's the title of the chapter: To Dance Through the Cosmos, The Journey to Hope, Healing, and Action. And it's just what you two have talked about. And we start with a quote from a Canadian black man who says, "The strongest flowers can grow through concrete." So hope, healing, and action. What we heard repeatedly was that healing needed to happen before you can get to change. And four sort of places where people saw hope was through spirituality, Eddie's story, through education, through community, and through family. And people talked about family. It wasn't just the immediate family, extended family, and, you know, those relationships. And when people talked about community, that we're really talking about social activism. So hope, healing, and action through those four pillars was really what African Canadians told us through this study. People weren't just, yes, racism is happening. Yes, it's alive and well. Yes, it's entrenched in our institutions. Yes, it has an impact on our health and well-being. But darn it, we're fighting. You know, we're not going down easy. We're fighting. And we're fighting through our spirituality, through education, through family and community. Okay.
That's a great point for me to ask. How can individuals at the center, other individuals and groups of compassionate, justice, and freedom-oriented people, such as people you tend to find in Unitarian Universalist congregations, where do we fit? How do we respond to losses? How do we respond to oppression? That's a lot of questions for everyone, I'm sorry.
You do some training around employment equity, and oftentimes, you know, people again feel very overwhelmed. It's like, oh, you know, and everyone thinks change needs to start somewhere up above. And I always like to, I ask the question, you know, where does change begin, and is it an individual or institutional responsibility? And I say, then I respond and say, it's not an either or, but it's a both and. So individuals, you know, we need to point the finger towards ourselves. So we need to look at what we can do to change. Where can we have an impact? What can we do? What can we do that's different? And also the institutions in which we work, in which we socialize, in which we live. The woman who was sitting here from St. Mary's, what's her name?
Judy.
Judy. Judy was just sharing with me before she had to leave some research she's done looking at businesses and the racism in the business sector and the challenges she's having even having that published. I'm going to talk to her. So one of my actions from tonight is I'm going to talk to her. I want to see her work. And we'll put our heads together around, you know, how we move it forward. Challenging the status quo. Number one thing you can do, challenge the status quo from wherever you are. Don't accept it. When you see, hear, feel racism, be willing to step up and challenge it, because there's a perception that silence means consent. So when we can't afford for you to stand on the sidelines. So take a stand, speak out, dare to be brave, dare to lead the change you want to see. That's where I think you can start.
There was a famous story about Malcolm X in the 1960s when he was still in his radical racist phase before he had his final transformation, and he was coming out of a university school, and a young white woman came up to him and said, hey, you know, you're great, you're amazing, what can I do to help you? And he looked at her and just dismissively said, nothing, you know, you're white, you're part of the problem, there's nothing you can do. He was in his blonde hair, blue-eyed devil phase, and he later came to repent from that and to take a different position. But when I was writing this book, I interviewed Rocky Jones, who I'm sure many of you know, a prominent lawyer, human rights activist, and in the 1960s, a bit of a firebrand black leader. Here he is, here, speaking tomorrow night in Halifax. And I put that question to him: what would you have done in the 1960s if a well-intentioned but person like me came up to you and said, "What can I do to help?" And he said, he thought about it for a while, and then he said, if somebody's shoved me to the ground and they've got their boot on my neck and they're pushing me into the ground, what I don't need is for you to come down on the ground and ask me if I'm comfortable and try and adjust the dirt around my face and try and make me more comfortable on the ground. What I need you to do is to stand up and tell the guy who's got his boot on my neck, get off, back off. And I take that to mean, as a white Nova Scotian in the dominant group that is sitting on the other side of the table making the economic decisions, that means that we have, and it's not a guilt from history, but a responsibility to stand up and to say, you know, to just sort of acknowledge racism, to sort of deter it and deflect it. Because I'm sure a lot of us have had that situation when you're in a room and somebody says something and it's mildly racist or un-PC. And there's that panic moment when the white person looks around the room to see if there's anybody not white in the room who's going to call them on it. And I think we have to call them on it. You know, you have to deter it every time you see it. You have to educate yourself and others. So when people say, oh, Africville, that was just a slum that deserved to be bulldozed, well, look into it and learn that it wasn't. It was made into what it was deliberately and then bulldozed. And when people say it was, you know, removed to make way for the bridge, you can go down there today and see that it, the bridge doesn't touch Africville. That's a story that's repeated over. We tell that to ourselves to think it wasn't about racism. It was just a bridge, urban planning, like Scotia Square. You have to, you know, so I think my sort of takeaway, my action is to challenge this and to, you know, share that this story isn't just Eddie's story, it's my story too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The only thing that I'd like to caution people about is, and I always use the example of the Halifax Human Rights Advisory Committee, which was comprised of liberal-thinking white people who asked a couple of people of African, colored people of the day, to join them in their great crusade to right all wrongs and injustices. I caution people not to be paternalistic when they're dealing with other people. I don't care who they are, but we have been victims of paternalism in other people who thinking that they knew what was best for us, mm-hmm. with all good intentions, mm-hmm. all good intentions. But it does nothing to help the person that you're trying to help, because you're keeping them in a position of less than. You gotta be willing to walk hand in hand. You gotta be willing to let the person take the lead and you follow and support in any way you can. But I always say that, you know, and I've had so many examples of that, you know, first with the Halifax Human Rights Advisory Committee, secondly with the Ontario Museum, when the Royal Ontario Museum, when they brought the exhibit out of Africa to Canada, thinking that they were doing something great, illuminating African culture, which ended up being an insult to people of African descent, you know, because they didn't bother to consult. They didn't bother to ask the people, well, what do you think? They thought they knew. So that's the way of helping is to share and to be willing to listen. You know, the amazing thing, and you guys are all here, I don't know how many times, whenever an event is being held and it's deemed to be a black event, no white people show up. Why is that? I mean, you know, we are starting to see white people come to Africville now to our annual picnic and reunion. They're starting to come out, and I'm so very happy. But we are in our 27th year, and up until 3 years ago, I would all be on the radio, being interviewed, inviting the community out. Everybody is welcome to come to Africville. It's completely free. Bring your children. They'll have a great time, and yet never seeing them come. Why is it that whenever something is deemed to be an African descendant activity, that white people don't go? We go to white events. I mean, you know, we go to Neptune. We go, you know, to Rebecca Cohen. We go to the art galleries. We go, but never. And why is that? That's what you got to think about. That's the question you have to answer for yourself, because it's in finding the answer to that question that you'll find the answer to what can you do to help.
Mm-hmm. Can I just shamelessly put a plug in for tomorrow night's event?
Please do.
If anyone wants to pick up a flyer. So tomorrow night, the James R. Johnson Chair in Black Canadian Studies is hosting an event, a distinguished lecture by Dr. Rocky Jones, and is on the struggle for human and civil rights by African Nova Scotians, looking at the period 1961 to 2011. So if you want to continue the conversation that's been started here tonight, I invite you to go along, but I invite you to take someone else with you. Go to the event, take someone with you, and continue the learning, the unlearning, and the journey to change.
I think it's time. If there are questions now and or comments, we'd like to take a few before we close for the evening.
There's one here.
Can name is Eunice, and I want to thank the panelists for the comments and learnings. I'm from away.
Mm-hmm.
And three things that I learned today that I would like to follow up with a question is one to do with how, as people of African descent, learn helplessness and learn that they can be some kind of colonizing our mind to accept low standards. And the other thing that I heard is that to address racial justice is a collective issue. And because I'm from Maui, I honestly will say through a personal experience, I didn't know what racism was until I experienced it within a church setting as a first incident. And then the second incident I experienced racism, that was four years after being in this country. I've been in this country for 11 years. The second scenario was in a classroom. And since that time, I have had the burden of trying to understand what racism is, how we can deconstruct whatever that has happened. And I have a big burden to reach young people. And so my question is around how can we, if it's a collective issue, it's not just a black Nova Scotian or a black people thing or white people, how can we open doors for people who don't share the history? Because I will be very wrong to say I understand African experience, because I never grew up, I'm just trying to learn about it. But how can we learn to share a hope as a group for the black Nova Scotians who have been here for 400 years and recent immigrants who have African heritage feel comfortable to have that conversation even when we don't share the history? And as someone who is interested to really understand what racism is and how we can have racial justice, because what I'm seeing in literature is that we can't take the word race or racism out of the books or people's mind, but how can we start a conversation, whether you are African from Maui, whether you are non-white from Maui, and forget about those labels, and have a conversation and engage young people in addressing racial injustices.
Is that directed to someone in particular?
No, the panel.
Thank you.
Those are very good questions, very deep questions. How do we engage our young people? Well, I mean, you start engaging young people in areas of interest to them. And I'm not young, but I can remember things that caught my interest were stories and storytelling. And I think you have to start there. You have to start by finding a way to engage young people, and then build, and then work along with them. You talk about people of African descent from away who haven't shared in the history, and absolutely right. But one thing that I've always said that this province is missing out on, they're missing out on the experience of us as African Nova Scotians living in this society, and using our experience as a way of engaging recent immigrants into the province, so that our survival techniques that we have developed in order to survive in this society is something that we can share with new immigrants coming here. One of the problems that we have here in Nova Scotia is that we get immigrants coming into Halifax and Nova Scotia only to quickly see them leave. And they leave for places where they find themselves, people from their same country, people that share their interests. Well, one way of retaining them to stay here in Nova Scotia is to make that connection with our communities. And it's not just Africville. We have, you know, the Prestons, we have Cherrybrook, we have Hammonds Plains, we have Beachville, all within HRM. And then outside of HRM, we are found everywhere in this province. So I think that by engaging us, the government, in terms of its programs, to reach out into the immigrant community coming in, I think would surely help bridge that gap.
I think you'd mentioned, white people don't come to black events. And speaking from my own experience, like before I met Eddie, and that was the first time I've been to Africa, was when I met Eddie a few years ago for the summer reunion. And a big part of it was fear. Like, I just felt like this is not my place. Yeah. And it's you can't...
The Nat Turner syndrome?
Yeah. And like the Prestons, even today, you know, people joke about it, that it's a dangerous place, and that as a white person, I just shouldn't go there. And you know, it's just this sort of pervasive fear. And when I went to the Black Cultural Center, you know, I kind of slunk in the front door, and I had, even though I don't feel guilt for what happened before, I still felt a sense of shame that I just an uncomfortable place to be, and it is a very uncomfortable place to be. But it's probably a good thing to make yourself uncomfortable and go there, and as you say, explore why you feel uncomfortable there. And as, you know, in reality, when I went to Africa for the first time, it was wonderful. I was welcomed. And even now, every time I, you know, when I go for the summer, you know, just to visit Eddie, it's you know, it's become a sort of a part of my home now, an important place for me in the summer reunion, mm-hmm. even though I don't have any family ties. It's just a wonderful place to go and to walk through and talk to people and catch up. But I think people need to cross that bridge.
I'd say fear the fear and do it anyway. You know that, Irvin, would you agree with this statement? If we gave into the fears that we have, we wouldn't get out of bed.
Exactly.
Would not leave home.
We wouldn't leave home.
Would not watch television. Would not turn on the radio.
Yeah.
You know, we would be all hermits. Really, if we gave into the fears that we have, we wouldn't do anything. So be comfortable with the discomfort, fear the fear, but do it anyway. So whether it's bridging same race, but looking at differences, or bridging across race, or bridging across age, or whatever it is, you know, we have barriers that get in our way of interaction, of linking, of connecting with people. You know, fear will hold us back. Fear the fear and do it anyway.
I have a quick sort of question to add to this, and I'm just curious as to why you think. I've been told there's not a lot of people of color in the audience. There's not a lot of Black Nova Scotians here in this audience. That doesn't surprise me. I got to say that I did. I probably sent 100 messages to every Black cultural, sports, and recreational, and historical, every possible group within HRM, as well as individuals and so forth. I, you know, just as a matter of in promoting this event. How do we bridge that place where we get beyond discomfort, or we get beyond that same old, you know, or dismissing things? How do we make it so that I want to go to Africa because it's going to be a fun experience to go to the annual reunion for me, rather than I should go because I want to show what a white, lovely, liberal, inclusive person I am. So how do I do that? This great liberal religious tradition, which espouses inclusiveness and diversity, and how do we have a very kind of singular, non-diverse congregation? Mm-hmm. Regardless of what we say, that's kind of what happens. And I ponder these things, but you know, I kind of wonder how do we start bridging that? How do we? It's not just forcing ourselves to get be in conversation, dialogue, and in community together. I think how do we get to that place of comfort?
Fake it till you make it.
Okay.
You know, you won't be happy the first time. I mean, you just said it, right? First time you went to Africa, there was fear and anxiety and so on. But I bet when you go now, you don't feel that.
Mm.
You're probably already looking forward to next summer's event.
Mm.
I used to do, before I started teaching, I worked in the community and I did marriage counseling, and I hated it. But one of the things I would say to couples, if you want this relationship to work, fake it till you make it. I don't know if they did or not. But I say, you know, you won't be happy the first time, the second time, the fourth time, the 10th time, the 20th time. You may be doing it because there's a sense of obligation. I don't care what starts the process, but just do it. And just keep doing it. And don't turn back and don't give up. I talked to the lady here from the church in Bedford, United Church, I think? Yes. They, for 10 years, they did a March 21st event. And, you know, she was saying she didn't see not just her, but her organization didn't see the change they wanted to see. They did it for 10 years. They didn't get the result they wanted. So they're no longer doing it. But, you know, I think some people are missing it. When you stop doing it, some people are missing it. But that kind of event that they were doing every year, that brought people together. People looked forward to that event, and they knew that it was a time when people gathered across faith traditions. So there are ways you can do it. Maybe, you know, create a partnership.
Thank you. We can take one more comment or question.
Hi, my name is Marie-Claire Arson. I'm actually a graduate of AST. But when I heard Dr. Bernard speaking about it in Irvine as well, saying, you know, I can recall very distinctly, when we talk about education, a professor telling me, I did my research, actually my thesis on, and it's called Applicating Catholics of Southville from Black Catholics, because the history, as we all know, has been written by, hello, I thought I recognized you. he was also a helpful hand in part of my thesis. But we all know that the history has been written by whites in their version of, if I'm not wrong.
Okay.
And I hear you say, because my husband was black and from the area, and I can remember him saying to me, well, you know, why do you have to make a distinction if you have black friends? They're your friends. But getting to the point of finding a supervisor to do my work, was impossible. In fact, I found no one here locally, and because I'm French-Acadian, I was able to find someone, and I went to look for people. But one of my professors said to me, Marie-Claire, you are not the right person to do this thesis and this research. And I said, why? I won't mention her name. Because I'm white? And she said, yes, you will not be accepted in the black community. And when I got to Southville, I was accepted with open arms. They were excited to see me there because finally, it didn't matter who it was, finally someone was taking the reins to write about their history. And as you said, in that community, the elders have gone and the history has gone. And if we miss the opportunity to write about your history, because you've been here as long as the Acadians have, not longer than that, then we're missing.
Mm-hmm.
We're missing the boat.
Absolutely.
We're missing, you know, the whole process of it. So I still have a lot of work to do on this journey. So, and I'm looking forward to doing more research on it. But, you know, I was not surprised because this year we presented the paper at the Congress 2011. I had two of my colleagues actually, Father Ed Warren, who's a Nigerian priest, who did come to Southville, and Professor Joe Natty, who's on the West Coast. First year, in 75 years of the Canadian Catholic Historical Association, that there has been black presence.
Mm-hmm.
So we're hoping to continue the journey.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Because we had Catholics in Africville, black Catholics, also in the community of Africville. And then if you go into the Anakinish Diocese,
yes. Their black church.
That's right. Yeah.
I offer you one last opportunity to brief closing remarks if you wish. You don't have to. If anyone has anything to close with.
Well, I just want to say that it's through dialogue, it's through what we're doing right here and now that is really going to knock down those walls, and we have to continue with that. And the most important thing is that people of African descent have got to be given the space to be able to strengthen themselves and grow themselves, and the opportunity has to be there. We're a very resourceful people. We have survived 400 years of conditions that no one was to survive in. So we are survivors. When you talk about, when you said March 21st and they did it for 10 years, and Nelson Mandela was locked up for how many years?
28.
Right? He didn't give up. He kept doing it. He kept doing it. And look what happened. You know, so as I said earlier, hope burns eternal, and you must always have hope. And in my struggles to have the recognition of what happened to my community made public, I don't know how many times people have asked me, "Well, Irvin, you know, like, what? Why do you keep doing it?" I mean, it was a 26-year struggle for me. People ask me, "Well, why do you keep doing it?" I said, "Because I believe, I know that right makes might." And I know that someday it's going to happen because I just believed. And I believe that on the strength of my ancestors. I believe that on the strength of all the folks that came before me. Because one thing, we as a people have been survivors. And I just knew that, you know, the stars will align. God will find a way, as he always does. And it might take, you know, it didn't matter to me. You know, when I started, I told people I was doing it for my children, and I ended up telling them I was doing it for my grandchildren. Because it didn't matter, I would be telling them that I would have been doing it for my great-grandchildren, because I wasn't about to give up. And, you know, and even if the goal wasn't achieved during my lifetime, I felt that my doing would lead others to continue to do. You never know who you're going to inspire. You just don't know whose life you're going to touch, so you have to have hope, and we are one people. We're all Canadians. We're all Nova Scotians. Our history is a shared history. It's a very vibrant and rich history, and all we have to do is just open ourselves up to it and allow ourselves to be who we are as human beings, and it'll all work out in the end.
So I wanted to make a comment about the bridge, and for me the bridge was Eddie Carvery, and literally a bridge, because I met him at the summer reunion in 2008, and then couldn't stop thinking about him and his story, and found there was nothing written. So when I went back a couple of days later to propose that we collaborate on a book about his life, I parked my car up on what has subsequently been renamed Africville Road, that road that cuts by the park, and walked literally across a little plank bridge he had over the ditch into his compound of trailers, which sat where the church is today. And his former dog, Spike, a big sort of American Mastiff dog, was there barking. It was a very intimidating on every level. And me as a white Nova Scotian coming in to say, "Hey, can I work with you to tell your story?" And as you say, you know, you just fake it till you make it. So I was like, "No, I can do this. I can face the fear. It does work." I walked across the bridge. I knocked on his door, and he came down. And he was just the most friendly, welcoming person I'd ever met. And he invited me into his trailer, and he told me his story. And he never held back. He never, we were on the same page from the start. And he was so gracious to tell me his story so that I could share it with other people. So for me, that bridge, I would encourage you to take the same bridge, which is to go down and visit Eddie. He's still there. And you talk about Nelson Mandela. Eddie's now into the 41st year of his protest out in Africville. And what he's gone through out there and what he's gained out there is immensely valuable. And he's a very gracious host. So I would urge you to go down. Bring some kerosene if you can, because it's very cold and his kerosene heater runs through kerosene quickly. Double-double from Tim Hortons and maybe a sandwich. Sit down and some dog food for Diablo, his new... and go down and talk to him, because it's, you face the fear, you go over, you talk to him, and it's an amazing experience.
Thank you.